Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 83 on Friday, February 19, 2010. I'm recording tonight in the family cottage at Ocean Park, Maine. It was a sunny, austere afternoon, way out of season up here. I really like it this time of year because it's just so empty compared to all the bustle of the summer. We're going to be spending a couple of nights here so Darlene and a friend can attend a quilting class in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which isn't that far from here. Once the podcast is in the can, I hope to unplug for most of tomorrow and work on a couple of longhand writing projects by the big window looking out on the frigid Atlantic. Someone who is definitely not unplugged these days is Stephen Windwalker, whose Kindle Nation blog is the third best-selling blog at the Amazon store. Steve recently completed another of his regular surveys of his Kindle Nation, so I was pleased that he was able to talk to me in person on February 17th for an interview at his home in nearby Arlington, Massachusetts. I will admit that memories of the homemade blueberry pancakes he served me before our last interview in May of last year may have had something to do with my eagerness to arrange for an in-person interview during this brief visit to Cambridge. The big news this week was Amazon's announcement yesterday that the Kindle app for BlackBerry is now available. And I'll also take a look at a report that Apple may reserve the right to lower ebook prices in its soon-to-open iBooks store, in some cases all the way to, you guessed it, $9.99. This week's tech tip, I'll show you how not to remove your screensaver hack, if you have one, in order to obtain the latest Kindle software. In content, Will Delamater of EduKindle.com has a nifty new app that will enable you to create content using Wikipedia and other sources. And as always, I'll close with your amazing and varied comments. You can subscribe to this podcast at the iTunes and Zune stores or by going to the show notes page at thekindlechronicles.com. You can also hear the Kindle Chronicles on your smartphone using a handy podcast manager named Stitcher, which you can learn more about at stitcher.com. With that, let's turn to the news. As of yesterday, there are a lot of new devices that can now read Kindle content because of the Kindle for BlackBerry application. Heather Hollick sent me a message by Twitter saying that it looks like there are 36 million BlackBerries in service. That may be the worldwide number. This new app for BlackBerry is just for the U.S. devices. It's a big expansion of the number of devices that can read Kindle content on top of the 60 million iPhones and iPods that have the app. And, of course, Kindle for the PC soon will be getting the Kindle for Macintosh. Lance Ulanoff of PC World expressed some doubts about the size of some of the BlackBerry screens. He wrote, "Large screen BlackBerries like the Storm 2 may provide better reading experiences, but if you have a 320 by 480 screen like I do, you may think twice about downloading Kindle for BlackBerry Beta." Item 2 in news is Motoko Rich's New York Times piece yesterday quoting unnamed sources to the effect that Apple may not be quite the unalloyed booster of ebook prices that we had been led to believe. Her article was headlined, "Apple's prices for ebooks may be lower than expected," and the first sentence said, "Maybe ebook prices won't be rising so much after all." Why this good news? Well, she reported that as more details come to light of the actual negotiations between Apple and the publishers, quote, "it appears that Apple left room to sell some of the most popular books at a discount." She quoted at least three people with knowledge of the discussions between Apple and the five publishers who are on board to sell books in the iBooks store for the iPad. And these sources told Rich that, quote, "Apple inserted provisions requiring publishers to discount ebook prices on bestsellers, so that $12.99 to $14.99 range was merely a ceiling. Prices for some titles could be lower, even as low as Amazon's $9.99. She writes, essentially, Apple wants the flexibility to offer lower prices for the hottest books, those on one of the New York Times bestseller lists, which are heavily discounted in bookstores and on rival retail sites. Well, I hope Motoko Rich has this story right, and I'm sure there'll be lots more developments as the launch of the iPad approaches and beyond. Time for the tech tip. After uploading last week's episode, I saw on Andras Baston's Kindle World blog.blogspot.com blog that Amazon was releasing new firmware for the Kindle 2 and DX. The next day, I thought I'd take a few minutes and uninstall the font and screensaver hacks that I have on my Kindle. And that's necessary because you can't get the new updated firmware if you have modified the Kindle. And I've talked about this in the podcast in the past. I have really come to love the ability to put my own photos on my Kindle instead of those photos that come with it. That's the screensaver hack. And I've also enjoyed being able to darken and make slightly larger the font that I read the kind of default font in my Kindle. So I've done these modifications in the past, and it's always been pretty simple to uninstall them whenever Amazon updates the firmware. So I wasn't expecting much of a problem. I thought it'd be a routine matter, but I ran into real trouble. And by the time I got done with it, it was getting late at night, and I had sort of a Stephen King feeling that something had taken over my Kindle. And I actually got so desperate, I did a foolish thing. I did reset to factory defaults, thinking that would solve my problem. And so I wiped out everything that I hadn't bought at the Kindle store, and it just sort of got worse and worse. My luck changed, as it usually does when I asked for help. I posted a pathetic tweet on Twitter saying that I was having trouble, and I heard back very quickly from username My4Brats, who gave me some good advice in 140 characters at a time before finally tweeting, "Come on over to Kindle Boards and hopefully we'll be able to get you taken care of." Well, that was pretty encouraging words, and I went over to Harvey Choot's Kindle Boards forum, and sure enough, My4Brats, a.k.a. Heather D., joined me for some longer-form tech support, and the breakthrough was when she realized I was trying to remove that screensaver hack with an outdated uninstall file. When she pointed me to the right uninstall file, everything sailed along without any problems. So the moral of this story is Kindle Boards is a really great place to get friendly help and advice when you run into the kind of trouble that I got myself into. And it's also a good idea if you're using these hacks to save someplace in your system the uninstall files that you will need to make sure that you can put the new Kindle software up when it arrives from time to time, as it did last week. And I will have a link in the show notes to the file that Heather linked to for me, and it contains the files that worked, and so they'd be a good thing to hold on to if you're taking advantage of the ability to do these slight modifications of your Kindle. And thanks again to Heather for saving my 2.3.3 bacon. Stephen Windwalker began writing about the Kindle the day it came out in November of 2007, and in February of 2009, he launched what he called Kindle Nation, a blog and email newsletter, and really what turned out to be a way of life for him. I began by congratulating Steve on the recent one-year anniversary of his Kindle Nation blog, which is currently the third best-selling blog in the entire Kindle store, and that's ahead of Amazon's own Kindle Daily blog, which is free, and the New York Times' latest news. You can receive Kindle Nation directly to your Kindle for 99 cents a month. I asked Steve for his reaction to the success of Kindle Nation.
It's been kind of amazing. When they really widened the Kindle store to a lot more blogs other than a few pre-selected corporate blogs, that was May of 2009. And at the time, I was posting one or two posts a day, and I thought, well, might as well try this, but why anyone would subscribe to the Kindle edition when they can get it free online wasn't immediately clear to me. And I guess we recently passed 6,000 subscribers through the Kindle store. And one of the things that's become clear is that it is very convenient for people to get my posts in real time. Frequently, they do alert people to a free book or some piece of news that might be important for people to get right away. So I can see why they do it, and I continue to try and make it interesting to people, regardless of the way in which they're receiving and reading.
I think one of the big values too, because I get it on my Kindle, is just the regularity of it. Is it a daily goal that you have for yourself, or just frequently, or it seems
well,
like
it's certainly a daily goal. Yeah, I think so far, I think we posted, there were 85 posts last month in January, and we're somewhere around two or three a day. And they often tend to be several on Mondays and Tuesdays when I'm getting ready to do the weekly email newsletter. And I, at any given time, I tend to have three or four things that I'm intending to write a blog post about. And I try to clean up that list before the weekly email newsletter goes out. So,
cool. Well, one thing you've been writing a lot about is the kind of jockeying and strategic maneuvering between Apple and its associated five publishers and Amazon. And you were actually the guest on a brokerage that Colin Stewart, it was a call with people who they advise, or what was the nature of that call on February 8th that you were a guest on for Colin Stewart?
The way it's described to me is that they do offer investment advice, and it's a large, venerable firm in that field. And so there were quite a few institutional investors that were represented, and they were particularly prominent among the questioners. But then there were also representatives from Amazon and Google and Yahoo and Apple who were listening to the call. There may have been some representatives in the publishing industry who were listening to the call. And then there were folks like you and me, mm-hmm. just ordinary people.
Well, and one of the topics that came up was the publishers. You had said publishers seem to be fighting a rear guard action against Amazon, and I'm not seeing a lot to be excited for. Now, you were talking about the big traditional publishers, but what can you say more on that topic?
Well, I think it's fascinating to kind of look back, let's say 7 years to 2003, and take a look at what Amazon has done in the past 7 years, what the large traditional book publishers have done in the last 7 years, and what, say, a few other players, maybe Apple, Barnes & Noble, have done in the past 7 years. And we don't have time to go into all of that, but certainly I have this vision of that I call Bezos's nightmare, where back in 2003, let's say that Jeff Bezos was looking ahead to a point a decade away when somebody would have come up with a digital reading device, God knows who, and print book sales on Amazon would be off 40 or 50 or 60% in a decade or whatever time frame, who knows. And that would be a nightmare for Amazon. It would have been a nightmare for Amazon. And to take that capacity to think ahead and to transform it into corporate action, where the company pivots, comes up with a new device, and manages to totally transform the way it's selling product to its customers, books to its customers, is just a remarkable corporate story, a little narrative there. And then you compare that with, let's say, Macmillan or Random House or whomever, and you say, let's say they were thinking ahead to ebooks, and it seems like all they've been able to manage is to say, oh no, ebooks are going to cut into the nice juicy profits we're making on hardcover bestsellers, and we need those hardcover bestseller profits because we're paying for X 100,000 square feet in Manhattan, and whatever the reasons, and we have to send 10% off 10% of our profits off to Bertelsmann or Holzbrink or whatever the global corporation is that owns us, and so all that I see the publishers doing is trying to retreat and fire. Mm-hmm. And as they retreat and fire, it's kind of a scattershot approach, and they seem to be firing more at consumers, firing more at their own readers than frankly whoever might really be the enemy. And it's sad, because it does seem to me that the publisher, if publishers and authors were to embrace the ebook revolution, which we are well on the way to now, it could become a more profitable process for them than print book publishing.
But how do you see that? I've sort of always assumed that no matter what, there's going to be profits squeezed out of that sector. How could they actually benefit if they had a more proactive strategy on ebooks?
Well, if I was Random House right now and I wanted to sort of do, you know, I wasn't yet part of the Apple Five, which is your wonderful, wonderfully felicitous phrase for this, what I would call the price fixing collusive cabal with Steve Jobs. If I were Random House, what I'd be trying to do would frankly be to polish the pearls that made my company, my publishing company, and its various imprints, including Knopf and things like Vintage Contemporaries, and some of the wonderful things that Random House did in the middle to the second half of the 20th century. I'd be trying to make the most of my real strengths as a publisher and to weave that into the ebook process. Random House either owns or is in a position to recapture electronic rights to some of the greatest works in the English language in the last 50 years mm-hmm. or more. And they've done precious little to bring out Kindle formatted or ebook formatted versions of a lot of that work. That, you know, one of the funny things about this whole $9.99 price point controversy is there is not a lot of, there's not a seriously dug in Kindle owner consumer position about the pricing of backlist or the pricing of books that are otherwise in trade paperback. And I think there's openness to paying anywhere, say, from $5 up to $9.99 for those. So that if some of the traditional publishers were bringing out backlist titles, venerable, readable, brisk-selling backlist titles, some of the Richard Ford titles that were great vintage contemporaries back in the 80s and early 90s, there's a lot of money to be made on those, and very, very, very little cost. Mm-hmm. No production cost, no warehousing, no fulfillment mm-hmm. cost, no returns. And there's also none of those costs on the new bestsellers. So it strikes me that if you compressed all of the price points between $4.99 and $9.99, Random House could make a ton of money on its bestsellers.
Yeah, good point.
Because, you know, it could pay, I mean, right now all it's probably preparing to pay authors is 17.5% to 25%. And after that, the costs are not significant for those bestsellers. So if it's getting 70% from Amazon, $6.99, and paying $2.50 to an author, that's a nice piece of profit for something that requires little capital outlay. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to get too deep into the inner economics of the publishing industry, but it does certainly seem to me that there's room for a Random House to maneuver in a way that's friendly to readers, that honors the company's own tradition as being a gatekeeper and a tastemaker and mm-hmm. so forth, mm-hmm. and that is very profitable.
Well, turning to your survey is timely in thinking about this because you've actually had a chance to learn about ebook readers, specifically Kindle readers, but these are people that are using ebooks in a regular way. What part of this survey do you think that the big publishers should be paying most attention to in terms of what you learned about Kindle readers?
Well, a couple of things. One is that it seems very important at a time when there's controversy and change and drift in terms of what might happen to prices and what different players think ought to happen. It seems very important to look at what readers believe about the various players. And I think we found that when we asked people, you know, do you have positive, negative feelings about the various players in the publishing field, One of the things that was shocking was that 86% were positive about Amazon and 1% were negative.
And this is, you had how many participate this time? It's a big number.
1,892, which is the largest number we've had in any of our three surveys up to now. We had 1,250 with the first one, and then 1,683 in the fall of 2009. So this is a nice jump from that. So, you know, one of the things that that said to me is that Kindle owners are very conscious of their role in influencing the marketplace. And they know that primarily they influence the marketplace by what they do in terms of buying and reading books, but they also know that what they have to say is important. So it's great. It's kind of an exercise of citizenship when people decide, oh, I'm going to take, you know, even though this guy writes a long convoluted survey, I'm going to take 20 minutes and try and slog through it and provide some input. And it really provided a tremendous amount of interesting input. On that positive-negative question, though, we asked people to rate not only Amazon, we asked people to rate the big six publishers. 18% had a positive view, 35% had a negative view, and then there was a large 46% neutral. When you think about the fact that 50 years ago, again, let's take Random House and Knopf and Vintage, and you had a company that was highly respected. People really did cede to the big publishers that role of gatekeeper and tastemaker. It was very publishing companies were very avuncular, mm-hmm. influential Venerated. Forces. Yes, and it's changed so radically. And if I were a publisher now, I would be worried about that. They seem to understand that because it was very interesting in the recent Macmillan flap. Macmillan did not address readers directly at all. They spoke, the CEO, John Sargent of Macmillan, addressed his communications to agents and authors and then asked authors to go on the various online forums. And that's what the authors did. And then they went on to Doug Pressen, I think, directly to the New York Times and said that the American consumer has an astonishing sense of entitlement and a Walmart mentality, which may not be a great way to build connection with your readers.
What do you think if you were Jeff Bezos reading these survey results? Anything in there to make you worried or guide you in the decisions that he's going to be making in the balance of this year?
I think one of the things that must be both very exciting and pleasing and also a little frightening if you're Amazon is the incredible trust that people place in the company. That can turn on a dime, I think, and I think it was no accident that Amazon in its little tete-a-tete with Macmillan decided that the big step that it had to make was to do something that let its customers know that this pricing increase, 30-50% on Kindle books, if we were to believe what the publishers are saying, didn't come from Amazon. It came from the publishers, and that was one of the benefits of that move for Amazon is that our survey respondents really understood this is where that came from. They resented it. And large numbers of them, I think it was 72%, but I'm not looking right at the figure, said that because of the recent controversy, I'm now more price conscious. Mm-hmm. So you've got a very savvy, informed and or opinionated group of readers. That's going to be very beneficial to Amazon as long as they manage to stay right on the spine of that behavior, which is part of their corporate mission, which is to be customer experience driven. If they take any missteps where they are seen as colluding in any way with publishers or jobs or whomever, then I think that's going to blow up in their face. And so if I were Bezos at this point, I think I would be trying to exercise a great deal of discipline over my minions to make sure that we stay on the straight and narrow in terms of a certain kind of relationship with customers and really an alliance against high prices and that sort of thing.
That brings me to my last topic I wanted to talk to you about, which is the Kindle versus the iPad. We're a little over a month away from the emergence of the iPad. And you've done some pretty compelling calculations about the cost of a Kindle versus the cost of an iPad for reading because of the 3G costs and all. But if there are 2 to 3 million iPads sold, which is some of the estimates, aren't most of those people, if they don't have a Kindle already, and they have the ability to sit up in their chair with a book and everything, at least somewhat less likely to buy a Kindle this year, and therefore isn't that something which is likely or possibly going to result in lower sales of Kindles than if the iPad hadn't come out?
You're in Boston, so you can say either iPod or...
I'm dyslexic on that damn thing.
It's not easy, and the typing isn't any easier. I think that it's an interesting question. I mean, one of the ways to look at it is this: if you're running the Kindle Enterprise at Amazon, and you say, okay, well, we've sold 3 million Kindles so far, and people are going to sell 3 million iPads this year, and another million or two, God knows what other e-readers. Oh no, that means that we're down to only 292 million Americans who haven't bought a Kindle yet. And I think that is a pretty good way to look at the question, because I think, for one thing, in all of the responses that I've gotten to the survey questions, and also a lot of very interesting individual responses in comment form, it really seems that the Kindle and the iPad are two very different markets. There will be probably a 10 to 20% overlap of people who will buy both, and those people who will buy both also have a Mac, a netbook, a PC laptop, an iPhone, and
you're looking at one,
and two Blackberries.
Yeah, that's right.
These are people for whom the recession has not taken too large a bite, mm-hmm. And that's all well and good. I think that I got a lot of responses to the survey from people who said, yes, I'm going to get an iPad, but I wouldn't think of using it to read a book. Mm-hmm. There will be plenty of people who use it to read a book, and I will probably do both myself. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's a large market remaining, mm-hmm. and there isn't much indication to me that, okay, if there are 3 million iPads sold this year, what is the elasticity with Kindle sales? And I would guess that that figure might drive down Kindle sales by 250,000 to 500,000 units. Amazon will make that up. Mm-hmm. I would also guess, frankly, that 3 million iPad sales will drive down sales of iPod touches and iPhones. Mm-hmm. It stands to reason. It will certainly drive down sales of, what is it, $2,000 MacBook Air? Mm-hmm. Because it has more to do with a sort of mobile convergent device than it has to do with an e-reader. So I don't think there's a lot of bad news for Bezos and Amazon in the emergence of these other products. And frankly, I think that for every million units of sales of anything else that runs a Kindle for blank app, that's thousands of little ka-chings in the Kindle store.
Yeah.
So I think the future's pretty bright for the Kindle and the Kindle platform.
Well, let's close with the future of your own writing. You've got a book coming out, I think, this spring. Can you tell us what that's going to be about and when we'll see it?
Well, right now what I can say it's going to be about is going to be about trying to finish the book. it's the working title is Kindle Revolution. And it's really a story. First and foremost, which is that one of the things that I'm trying to do with it is to look at conflict and sort of the beats of a plot, mm-hmm. and to say that there have been some fascinating events. I talked about Bezos's nightmare back in 2003, and I haven't talked to Jeff about whether there was a nightmare, or he hasn't given me the freedom to speak to any counselors or anything like that. But I do think that there's a very interesting set of narratives that have gotten us to the point we're at now and will get us through the next couple of years. And what the book is going to try to do is to talk about the narratives involved as Jeff Bezos and Amazon have really reinvented the world of publishing. And it's kind of a fun, exciting project. And it's just something that I found myself writing about these things as much as anything else I was writing about these days in the course of blogging and other writing work. And it just made sense to try and organize the material into a compelling book. And it feels like it's going to be that.
So you're hoping, do you have a April 1st deadline or anything that you've imposed on yourself?
I think I said spring.
Spring. It'll be spring somewhere.
It's always springtime somewhere.
That's good. Well, now, if someone isn't familiar with Kindle Nation and your other work, what's the easiest way to find you on the internet?
Well, I think if you Google Kindle Nation Daily, you'll certainly be taken to the blog site. If you happen to ever come across the Amazon store or the Kindle store, you can certainly look up Stephen Windwalker. You can look up, you can type in Kindle Nation Daily and for just with a free 14-day trial and just 99 cents a month, you can subscribe to the blog. And I think if you do any Kindle reading, it will save you back that 99 cents.
If you are not yet familiar with Stephen Windwalker and the Kindle Nation, I urge you to take a look at this valuable source of information about all things Kindle. I also enjoyed meeting Steve's significant other, Betty, who joined us for pancakes, and she's the one who took the photo of Steve and me for the show notes page. So thanks, Betty, for taking a nice photograph of us. For content this week, I want to point you to a new tool created by the very creative Will Delamater, who's edukindle.com, that's edukindle.com. Blog and forum have become a lively gathering place for educators at all levels interested in using Kindles in the classroom. The tool is called eReadUp, and it allows you to select some articles from Wikipedia and other places and build them into a little Kindle book that you can load on your Kindle wirelessly or manually. When it shows up, it's got a nice table of contents, very readable, nicely formatted. If you want to try it out, simply go to www.ereadups, that's ereadups.com. You'll have a chance to put a topic in the search box about something, and the engine will deliver some articles, which then can be formatted in Mobi format, which is the one your Kindle can read, also EPUB for other readers. It's just pretty handy. I've tried it out myself. There are different levels at this point. If you want to participate at the beta test level, which sort of has some other features to it, and they're calling it premium, I'm not sure if they're going to actually be charging for some of the premium capabilities, such as there's a place that you can put your books that you're creating this way in an online folder. But in any event, it's very handy. And Will is... This is part of a larger project that he's getting going. It's called eReadia LLC. Essentially, the tool will become a more fully featured online authoring book building tool, he writes, for Kindle owners and eventually for schools. Time now for your comments. Richard Fisher emailed on February 6th that he had received his update for his Kindle DX, and it moved him from 2.3 to 2.3.2, but at the time of his message, he hadn't seen any changes that would relate to that update for the DX. I have to report the same. My DX updated, but at this point, I haven't had a chance to use it in a way that would show me any great improvements. Heather Hollick emailed some thoughts on a Sunday morning. She says, I have been listening to your podcast all week and I'm struck by the one element from the pricing discussion that seems to be missing from the debate. As the publishers scramble to control ebook pricing, everyone is comparing the price of an ebook to the price of a hardcover book, discounted or otherwise. However, the value proposition in MBA speak of an ebook is very different than the value proposition of a printed book. That is, What I get when I buy a printed book is very different from what I get when I buy an ebook. With a printed book, I get a piece of property that I own and can do with as I please. I can pass it on to a friend when I am done or donate it to a library. With ebooks and their inherent DRM, digital rights management, I have some kind of esoteric license to consume the content, but I don't really own it. I certainly can't pass it along to a friend or donate it to a library. Hence, the value of an ebook to me is very different than the value of a printed book. Granted, ebooks have additional values, e.g. convenience, speed of acquisition over printed books, but comparing ebooks to printed books is almost an apples to oranges comparison. Just because they contain the same words doesn't mean they are the same thing. Ultimately, consumers decide what they are willing to pay. It will be fascinating to see how the dust settles over the next few years. Well, Heather, I really appreciate that message. I've read it a couple of times, and each time I read it, I see more in it. So you got a lot of information packed in a short message that really highlights the complexity of these pricing decisions and how it strikes me that people that are sort of in one camp or the other, $9.99, not $9.99, it's a lot more complex than that for some of the reasons that you talk about. And I see that in my own behavior. I think that I'm committed to $9.99, but then I find myself sneaking off to buy a book for about $15 on the Sony Reader because it just looks like a novel I totally want to read. So I can't figure myself out, never mind have very convincing opinions on these things in theory. Good post. An email from Marie Sotiriou. I saw a post regarding this podcast discussing, she's talking about another podcast. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. It's discussing the Amazon-McMillan dispute, and I thought I would pass it along to you. One of the guests asked why Jeff Bezos has not publicly commented on the dispute, and I'm wondering why as well. Do you think that he has been silent so that he would not impact contract negotiations with the publishers? It will be interesting to see if Amazon was able to negotiate anything out of the finalized deal for readers. There are rumors circulating the web regarding opening up the Kindle for lending, similar to the Nook, but I really don't see a lot of value in that as it is structured today. I guess we will see how everything plays out. And that podcast link that she's referring to is from Telereed. Thanks, Marie. I began listening to that podcast, and it was interesting. I can tell you that the lending feature on the Nook, which I've tried, is limited because there's so few titles available at the Denver Public Library, at least. But it is something which I think it'd be great to have on the Kindle. And I remember when I talked with Ian Fried about it, he said, we just haven't had that many people ask for it. The implication being that if a lot of people did start asking for it, that Amazon being customer-driven would go in that direction. So let's get asking about it. I'm asking about it. I think it'd be great if we could borrow books on our Kindles. Maurice Lawless emailed regarding the iPad. I just recently started listening to your podcast about the Kindle, and I wanted to mention my personal reaction to the launch of the iPad. I've been interested in the idea of an e-reader for some time, but was waiting to see what kind of gadget Apple came up with to see if it would offer good competition. After watching the keynote, I can safely say I am completely convinced the Kindle 2 is the device for me. I already have an iPhone and have tried reading books on it, but much like many of your readers, the backlit LCD screen is just not comfortable for more than about a web page worth of content. I see the iPad as suffering from that same problem on a larger scale. That's not to mention the price, although I can see people making a jump to an iPad if they were interested in a Kindle DX. The paperback reading crowd like myself just can't justify paying $500 for something that's yesterday's LCD technology when there's a much more convenient e-ink device for half the price. I haven't made the plunge and bought my own Kindle yet. I'm hoping after tax season I'll have some spare cash, but when I do, I expect to enjoy it quite a bit. Thanks for your comment, Maurice, and good luck with tax season. Bob Anderson emailed, I have had my New York Times subscription for just a week, and boy, do I love it. You may have seen today's book review of Ken Gormley's account of the impeachment fiasco, The Death of American Virtue, which appeared in today's edition. This is a book I'd love to read. I went into Amazon and saw the Kindle version. It's going for $19.25. Are they kidding me? Of course not. That is versus the $35 price that no one pays and the Amazon price for the DTB, that's Dead Tree Book, version being $23.10. In other words, the Kindle version is just 17% less than the DTB version that Amazon sells. "This is awful," Bob writes, "and I hope no one buys this ripoff version on Kindle." He wonders why Amazon would even offer the Kindle book at such a high price. "I'd rather tell Crown, hey pal, we'll sell it, but not when it is barely less than a printed version." You know, I'm getting more reports of these high prices showing up, so it's discouraging, and you know, it's hard to tell which way things are going. Brian Rupert emailed on February 6th, "I had to lay my wife's Kindle One to rest today. Per Kindle support, it must be an internal problem. Oops, you are out of warranty. Thank you. So I reluctantly gave her my Kindle 2 and am in the market for a new reader. Here's the $64,000 question," Brian asks. "Do you think that Amazon will update the Kindle reader for the iPhone to an iPad app, one that will take the new real estate and not just do a pixel doubling or however they blow the iPhone apps up to full screen?" Well, Brian, as it happens, this past week, Amazon answered that question by making a passing reference to an iPad app for the Kindle. So if you're thinking about holding out to see what that might look like on the iPad and possibly buying that as your replacement for the Kindle you so generously gave your wife, then it might be worth looking for. Craig Scarberry from Springfield, Ohio emailed, "Imagine a Kindle device with the same GPS location technology that currently resides in most cell phones. What if our Kindles could be aware of other Kindles in, say, a 50-mile radius? Imagine being able to view this Kindle user's profile and possibly interact with them through a messaging system. A good topic for one of your podcasts might be to discuss with someone how social networking and digital reading on ebook devices could be merged." Well, Craig, this comment makes me think you'd enjoy listening to my interview yesterday with Andrew Savickas of O'Reilly Media. That's at thereadingedge.com, because he was thinking out loud as well about all the amazing things that could be done with a device that is not trying to be just a book only better, which is how he sees the Kindle. Sean from New York City emailed regarding last week's show, "I enjoyed your interview with Steve Garfield, but was saddened to hear that he's publishing errata to his book via his website. I agree with you that there's a difference between the two reading experiences you outlined, engaged social reading versus solitary monkish reading, but despite which is your preferred mode, surely there's no excuse for not pushing out errata and updates via WhisperNet. This one's going into a Kindle feedback." Well, I agree with Sean on that one, and I'd say even monks like to have their reading material free of typos. Thanks, everyone, for those good comments. You can leave an audio comment for me at 206-666-2713. You can email me at podchronicles@gmail.com or leave a comment on the show notes page at thekindlechronicles.com. As you probably know by now, I will be giving away a free 6-inch Kindle and an accessory of your choice, thanks to the generous support of Octovo, a provider of accessories for smart devices, including the Kindle, the iPhone, and other ebook reader and smartphones and devices. All you have to do to enter is become a fan of the new page that I've created in Facebook. To get to it, log on to Facebook and search for Reading Edge. Except for members of my family and employees of Octovo, anyone who is on the list of fans at noon Mountain Time, April 1st, will have their name entered in the drawing for the Kindle and accessory. You can subscribe to my new podcast about the ebook revolution at thereadingedge.com. It's at the iTunes store. Next week, I will be back in Denver, and I have a Skype interview scheduled on February 24th with the legendary internet marketing philosopher Seth Godin, who has a new book out and who has in the past made some really sage observations about the ebook scene on his blog. So I'm hoping I'll be able to talk to him about that as well as his new book. One last thing I want to share with you today is that a fan of the podcast on the Facebook page, Sergeant Andre B. Corbin, will be taking a complimentary Kindle and accessories with him when he deploys for active duty with the U.S. Army in Afghanistan next month, and that's courtesy of M-Edge Accessories. I saw that Andre had expressed the hope that he'd win the Octovo drawing for the Kindle on April 1st, so I contacted Patrick Mish, CEO of M-Edge Accessories, to see if his company might be interested in donating a Kindle and accessories for Andre. Patrick quickly agreed, and they are working with Andre on the details, which I'll have for you next week. So congratulations, Andre, on your new Kindle, which you'll be taking to Afghanistan, and thank you for your service. Music for my podcast is Ramonk by Eval Monegat on the Variations in Time, a jazz perspective CD by Public Transit Recording, courtesy of IODA PromoNet. This is Len Edgerly from Ocean Park, Maine, for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.